I mean, it's still peaceful, and you have a revolution because Trump. It's like what we also like discussed with this Tyler. It's like Trump is revolutionary. He, despite the fact that he is a quote unquote conservative or right wing person, he's a revolutionary. He changes everything. So you also need to think about how, you know, it fits with your perception him as a conservative. He's not conservative. He's a revolutionary, so to speak. He changes like the whole dynamic of the political system, institutions.
He's very disruptive, certainly, and well, I mean, if you think about the classical thing about an increased role of Congress, or that as a, I mean, the kind of checks and balances are either because the respective branches of government don't assert their power, or because they are being sidelined, or a mix of both. I mean, that's what's happening. But I mean, some people talk about fascism all the way, right? So, I mean, it's a very also polarized debate on what Trump actually represents.
But then that's the same point of translation, I feel. It's like, because something what I think powerful in Latourian argument and why he was so obsessed with the concept of diplomacy, I guess he saw correctly that in the modern world where change is happening so quickly, people lost this idea of how you really take someone's values and understand them, mm-hmm. instead of translating them in your own language. Because mm-hmm. that's what people do. Instead of saying like Trump, you know, again, just trying to take Trump's values at kind of for what they are, people create the narrative that he's a fascist, that he's, I don't know, all of that. So to speak, it's the same type of conceptual problem that people face. And with, of course, Democrats and Republicans. And then you have like this, of course, the whole, that there's something broken in the way people communicate with each other, especially groups. Like, and then, of course, it manifests in American case, I mean, brilliantly in polarization between Russia and the West, like the U.S. and China. I mean, I haven't looked at that in from this perspective, but I'm pretty sure people who do research, they would probably say the same. Just this basic misunderstanding of how you take someone's values and try to understand them and act upon that. Not abandoning your values, but again, how do you come to like real sense of diplomacy? And then, of course, like I guess from Latourian perspective, it has more to do with the West, so to speak, with this like just this modernist narrative where you really try to kind of because the way the history evolved, and because like the whole concept of, you know, we create the kind of the universe, like we create, like as Westerns we create the world. It's like everyone else values, they are not important. Like our values, that's what we should, you know, promote. And they kind of still, and you see it in Europeans, of course, because Europeans now think that their values are so important that, like, and it's just that everyone should just, you know, everyone should be European. But then they refuse. But then they refuse even accept Russians as Europeans, so to speak. So it's like there is already kind of like what he calls a category mistake, which I think is basically misinterpretation or mistranslation or just kind of like, and then of course you go to, and so many layers, because you go to academia and that's what academia teaches you. Academia teaches you like this rigid rational thinking that basically excludes other perspectives. It forces you actually to put everything from rational perspective and completely ignore other perspectives. And this is
most theories, most approaches.
Dominant theories.
Yes, the dominant theories, because they take a priori assumptions, right, that they hold, and they take that for granted. And of course, that's a point of departure where analytically you are,
right,
being streamlined or narrowed down in a very specific way. But I mean, kick right off.
Yeah. And coffee? Or?
I'm fine.
I know. I thought it's so. It's still. It's. It's
no, no, I had mine.
Okay. Let's start, I guess, and try to disentangle my why we're recording that. It's just to try to help me to develop the idea of my hypothesis. And we can discuss and go into the direction of how it relates to current events, so to speak. So, I mean, let's just start maybe what's on your mind in relation to Trump. Let's go from there.
Well, on my mind, I think there are so many things on my mind, but I think for our conversation, I think the most relevant one is the very awkward kind of communication he currently uses when it comes to the Ukraine war, I think.
Right.
So,
do you think
in caps, stop Vladimir? Did he say stop Putin or stop Vladimir? I mean, something after Kyiv was bombed, he said it wasn't helpful. And, you know, the way he seems to communicate also openly with leaders, meaning Zelensky and Putin, is something I find awkward. Of course, people do that in press conferences all the time. But this idea that you address the respective leaders whom you have talked to on the phone also via kind of a secondary line of communication, which is a social network, I find that's somewhat awkward. Maybe it's the degree of vanity or, I don't know, some analysts say putting up pressure on Vladimir Putin, although I wouldn't know what that pressure is all about. Yeah, that's sort of awkward.
But would you say from your observations that I have a feeling that his policy making revolves around realism, at least if he doesn't conceptualize it that way, because I mean, obviously what we discussed previously, I mean, Trump is not the person who probably is very knowledgeable about international relations as a discipline, but at the same time, he's surrounded by people who are probably thinking from realist perspective. And at least from my observations, I mean, he's probably trying to like push for this realist approach to foreign policy, which for Trump means, I guess, predominantly focusing on the competition with China and something even Russia. It's something like a secondary, second degree issue, right? At least that's how I interpret.
I'm not sure. I mean, if you sort of, because we just started off by saying that one of the problems that many of the dominant IR theories pose is that they are actually too rigid in the kind of assumptions that they hold. So they don't leave a lot of room for interpretation or surprise or maybe also some counterintuitive thinking. So I think, yes, by and large, maybe realism comes closest to some kind of Trump worldview. At the same time, I do see a kind of schizophrenic aspect of it. On the one hand, Trump seems to be the sort of transactional guy who wants to get things done, forging deals and things like that, and bringing the Ukraine-Russia war to an end. So, I mean, I think it's that as such, as a policy aim, is something, you know, laudable and positive. At the same time, he seems to be doing that out of a very awkward self-perception of, on the one hand, maintaining this idea or narrative of America as the sole superpower. At the same time, many of his policy decisions actually seems to suggest that he is more aware or technically admitting that the power of the US globally is actually waning as opposed to Joe Biden. So I think this entire also rhetorical hubris that we saw with Joe Biden, that, I mean, Ukraine could eventually reconquer all of the lost territory, I think that was at least naive. Right. And I mean, a lot of the rhetoric about the kind of moral superiority of the West and things like that, I mean, that is something that Trump threw out of the window. At the same time, so the way he actually tries to, I mean, with his tariff policy, that is something I think where he is on the one hand antagonizing former allies and also significantly, you know, reducing trust amongst allies. At the same time, he's really completely changing also the way how diplomacy is being conducted. Or rather, I mean, there is something else, because it is anything but diplomatic. So, I mean, I think we are really seeing this entire process towards a more multipolar system is something that I think the Trump administration is, at least also with his actions, more aware of than maybe the former Democratic administration. At the same time, I think they seem to be incredibly naive when it comes to some of the things to which that leads. I was really surprised to see that they wouldn't take into consideration that, you know, if they take a certain decision, such as leveling tariffs at, you know, friendly countries, that this could somehow backfire. Or, I mean, that they are on the... I mean, you could see that, I think, in that example of, on the one hand, he's talking about annexing Greenland, really creating a diplomatic row with Copenhagen. I mean, and that's already a euphemism. At the same, and then, like, 24 hours later, he's talking about high egg prices and also explicitly talking about Denmark, who could export eggs to the U.S. So I think that's a very strange way of signaling. Now, if you put yourself into the position of a Danish politician, I mean, one day you get, hey, by the way, there is this, I mean, quasi-sovereign part of your country, which is a large landmass covered by ice and inhabited by roughly 60,000 people, that, I mean, where we would like to increase our presence and maybe even annex it. And then, so that's clearly not a friendly act. And the next day, you are actually being asked for help on a very mundane or banal aspect, such as delivery of eggs. So I thought this kind of communication is really new. It's very strange. And I still haven't been able to make sense of it.
I think the way I at least I make sense, I guess they're trying to, I guess, again, as you said, maybe to reconfigure American position in the changing world. And also, I think they're way much more aware of kind of waning American power. So they try to probably redistribute resources because previous administrations were so bad with that because they expanded so much. So they're trying to pull back and say, okay, where are our real priorities? And they're doing it on the go. And again, from their thinking, at least the main thing is like how we can really win competition with China. And everything else is kind of like a secondary.
But what do you mean with competition by China? Because I see the very same, say, schizophrenic situation, or at least, you know, tensions there as well. On the one hand, as you, I think, rightly pointed out, one of the intentions by the Trump administration to end the war in Ukraine seems to be that they then sort of concentrate more on anything that is happening in the South China Sea. At the same time, the way that the Ukraine war could come to an end, if the so-called Trump plan were to be implemented, I mean, it would technically, at least from my understanding, rather incentivize the Chinese to eventually invade Taiwan. And now, and if you then have a country that is at least suggesting, or at least keeping it unclear, whether an attack on either a neighbor, such as Canada, with, you know, things about the talks about the 51st state, or we will get Greenland one way or the other, I think, as he put it. I mean, if you put out statements like that, I mean, you cannot possibly think that you can convince Xi Jinping of not invading Taiwan. So, I mean, and on top of that, without suggesting that China has the right to invade Taiwan, but if it were to, I mean, the question would be sort of what would the strategic position of the US be in that situation? I mean, is it about freedom of navigation, everything that we could see from the signal, leaked signal chats, that, you know, it's considering itself still to be the global dominant force because, you know, it has this power projection capability that really spans globally. So, I mean, it can ensure that shipping routes are kept open. If it's about that, I mean, that, I think, could be communicated way more forcefully. But, I mean, this entire... It's not even a strategy, and it wasn't one under Biden either. I mean, this entire idea of what is the American presence in Asia except for being or having troops in Korea and in Japan? So what is the strategic interest as such? I mean, basically just achieving the kind of regional balance of power? That seems to be the case. But I mean, right. I think as such, it hasn't been communicated very clearly. At least maybe I've overlooked statements. But I mean, for me, it is a very ambiguous kind of approach because I don't see the kind of big picture, except for, well, if we end the war in Ukraine, we can put our attention towards the Indo-Pacific and ensure that we somehow, you know, might be able to fight a war with China. But over what would that be? I mean, would that be...
Right.
I mean, I think would that really be if China attacked Taiwan? I'm honestly very skeptical in that regard.
Yeah, and it's also, I think, from American, at least, I'm not sure what is the biggest debate in America itself. I mean, I would guess it's probably internal problems and issues. So maybe from his perspective, from strategic perspective, if he has one, it's definitely something to focus on, again, bringing like to bring economic prosperity to the US. And that's what he tries to do with tariffs, right? Because even from, I don't follow, to be honest, the news closely, especially in relation to US-China relations. But at least from the snippets I've seen, it's basically this idea, well, you know, China has so much economic output and production output. And we have to, first of all, match this output because we are lagging behind in terms of production of ships, production of everything, basically, because China outperforming the US. So what they try to say, instead of, kind of we like at least what they're doing, right, we are ending this era of basically globalism, and we really try to come back to this era of, you know, American self-development, so to speak. And which, I mean, basically what pre-World War II style, just to really focus on creating production in the US and making the US attractive economically again. And this is, I guess, the strategy. I mean, for it to work, you need to have consecutive administrations, obviously, because if Democrats come to power, they would probably reverse it. But it seems from, again, if you think about tariffs, that's what he tries to achieve, to bring production back to the US. And that's, I mean, what he's really dissatisfied with outsourcing production to other countries. So I would think so.
I think as such, this entire idea about bringing especially back manufacturing, because right. They are rather high paying jobs. I mean, so the question is Trump really trying to actually, at least that's what he rhetorically states, you know, caring for the middle class or for workers? I'm quite skeptical, to be honest. But I think as such, what we are seeing is at least across the aisle, meaning Democrats and Republicans, considering that there is a problem of the dependence on China. You could see that with any kind of COVID protective equipment. Mm-hmm. You can now see it with anything from like semiconductors and things like the CHIPS Act and stuff like mm-hmm. that. So the entire idea, even of the Democrats, was that of friendshoring, right? So, I mean, we want to change supply chains to an extent that we reduce our dependence on China. So that was already in place. And now right. That has been sort of amplified by the tariffs that Trump introduced. I mean, at the same time, you see that what he actually wants to achieve cannot be done overnight. And the way you see that, for instance, is again by this ridiculous idea that you then have. I mean, he's sort of ratcheting up or increasing tariffs almost on a daily basis, and then somehow notices, oops, I mean, while the iPhones are designed in California, they are still produced in China. And if I really pursue that path of the tariffs, I mean, the iPhone will end up costing $3,000. I think that's what happened. So, I mean, what did he say? Well, there are some exemptions. I mean, if you ship smartphones into the US market, like Apple iPhones, the tariffs that I otherwise introduced on Chinese products won't apply. So, I mean, you see as such, it's not a very coherent thing. So, I mean, since we also will talk about, you know, Russian perspectives, Chinese perspectives, there long-term thinking, their mm-hmm. sort of strategic consistency. I think what we see as such, there seems to be a consensus, yes, American power is at least slowly decreasing when mm-hmm. it comes to global dominance. And we also have to change the way that we have to reorganize our economic system because mm-hmm. income inequality is high. We have an increased polarization of society, all the things that we can read about daily in the press. But I mean, this remedy that is being presented is one that, if it was pursued strategically, might make sense. But I mean, mm-hmm. it is sort of being introduced in a fashion that, you know, simply cannot materialize in the short term. So, I mean, yes, it makes absolute sense to maybe, you know, bring back some manufacturing jobs. At the same time, a lot of that will be automation. So maybe there won't be that many jobs that you can gain. I mean, maybe the stronger lever would be addressing income inequality, having a better and just and equitable tax system in place. I mean, these are all questions that I think seem not to be happening in the United States. And I think when it comes to the overall strategic positioning of the US, I think irrespective of whether it was Obama or Biden or mm-hmm. or Trump, they all fare rather bad when you compare it to Russia and China. I think they, in that sense, Russia and China are way more consistent in their strategic positioning. I'm not saying that, you know, I appreciate or actually support, you know, Russian aggression or, you know, invasions of other countries. But I mean, as such, the kind of statements that come out of the Kremlin, sort of this is how we see Russia's role in the world, as such, seem to mm-hmm. be more consistent from what I can observe.
I think in the American sense, America was actually very consistent also throughout 90s, zeros, 2010s. Another question is, it seems the strategy didn't really work out. And the strategy of...
I would agree until, say, the 90s and the 2000s. So that you like could call it the age of hubris, right? Where, I mean, they...
And of course, this didn't work out. Because now you have to deal with problems. And America basically at least now brings in terms of like self-awareness that, you know, we ended up in a place that is not actually beneficial for us. And then they, of course, they are overextended. I mean, that's pretty clear. And of course, the Ukraine issue, when Trump explicitly says that it's not our problem at all. I mean, I guess his message now, I mean, hey, we try to solve it. And this is what they're saying, right? If not, we'll just, you know, pull back and just abandon the issue whatsoever.
I mean, that might make sense. I mean, you can see, again, that's in a long sort of foreign policy tradition of the United States. If you take a very long time period of isolationist, you know, trends that were always there. I mean, you could also see, you know, that happen after the First World War, right, in the interwar period where the U.S. was incredibly isolationist. America has always been very, you know, with the Monroe Doctrine, very much aware of, you know, anything that's mm-hmm. happening in their backyard that you know, they consider to be at least a danger or a threat. But otherwise, I mean, there have always been those isolationist tendencies to say, hey, I mean, we are basically, you know, kilometers, thousands of kilometers or miles away from any of the military hot conflicts. So why would we care, or why should we care? And I mean, this is a debate that has been reignited or started again.
Right.
And but then again, it is not consistent, because I mean, if you take that as a position of saying, hey, we can bring back jobs home to the United States, we should reduce our military presence across the globe, we should stop, you know, being the, what it was often, you know, termed by mm-hmm. especially anti-Americans, the world's policeman. If they were to pursue that, then they would also basically have to hand back, or I mean, at least allow the Chinese to be way more, you know, powerful or increase their room for maneuver in Asia. But I mean, if they say, okay, we pull out of Ukraine is not our problem. Right. We pull out of Europe. We don't care what's happening in Europe. Leave it up to the Russians and the Europeans mm-hmm. and the Ukrainians to sort this out.
Right.
Then, I mean, it's strange that they see, oh, but this is not the kind of logic we apply to Asia and China and Taiwan. So, I mean, for me, that's, again, inconsistent. So, I mean, also, you know, now seeing how they have been bombing the Houthis in Yemen is something that you could say is more or less consistent with regard to, it sounds like, it is a euphemism, right? A lighter footprint, in quotation marks, in the Middle East, because, of course, also they have significantly reduced their presence in the Middle East or their diplomatic endeavors. But, I mean, also there I don't see any kind of clear strategic vision.
And it's interesting.
Except for short-termism.
I think the way you describe, the way you describe it, at least what rings, like the word that kind of comes in my mind, is just like you describing just the chaos, and they try to mitigate kind of the self-inflicted chaos. I think that they most of the things that was created by Americans. So that's why it's for them. I think it is so hard to understand how to deal with that, because every issue that even if you take, for example, China, right? I mean, Americans created strong and economically, you know, prosperous, independent China. And now they have to deal with that problem themselves. I mean, Americans created the war in Ukraine, so at least contributed to the war in Ukraine to a certain extent. And now they have to deal with that as well. And so many other problems in the Middle East and so on and so forth. So I think I understand why I think it's hard for Trump to mitigate this, because, of course, Trump just, as a revolutionary figure in American politics, who is anti-establishment, I guess that's, we can definitely, you know, if there is anything to say about Trump from pure description, he's definitely anti-establishment. And now he tries to basically reverse, well, I mean, decades of American foreign policy making, specifically focusing on this idea of retreating. Because America has been expanding since, I mean, at least the end of World War II. That was American position. And of course, it intensified after the end of the Cold War, which for me, for example, the way a lot of people try to talk about, you know, war in Ukraine, and they say, well, but this is a complete breakage of post-World War II order. I think it's such an incorrect description, because the world order changed after Cold War. It's pretty clear. It's not the same world order anymore. It evolved.
Why would I argue that this is, I mean, those critics or, you know, people who make that argument, I think they are basically talking about the kind of post-World War II world order, which is often, you know, also referred to as the liberal world order, meaning at least anything that's in the United Nations Charter. Now, you can always say, well, there have been so many double standards, and I mean the way of, you know, sovereignty of nations, the inviolability of borders and things like that have also been, you know, not accepted by some Western powers after 45. I mean, I don't want to go down that rabbit hole, but I think where I don't agree with you is on the point of Trump being a revolutionary, because I think I would say he's disruptive, certainly, and he upends a lot of, you know, the diplomatic traditions. I think he's not aware of that he's often destroying the fabric of also what, you know, helped America actually to maintain its dominant position in the world. I mean, especially with regard to allies who are not really sure how to deal with the United States. I think still as such, for a revolutionary, he would need to have some, I mean, that means really getting rid of the old order. And I think there he often uses that kind of rhetoric that, I mean, everything that the Democrats did, or that, you know, something like the deep state, or the way that, you know, Americans engage globally has been detrimental to national interests, or otherwise cost a lot of money, or both. So, I mean, that as such is not necessarily a wrong description, or it's not completely off. At the same time, I mean, he doesn't have any remedy or solution for that. I mean, because, I mean, again, if he said, you know, this is all costing us way too much money, let's just, you know, reduce our presence in the world fine. I mean, who could do that? But I mean, again, he's very aggressive, at least rhetorically, towards China. And otherwise, he seems to do things like in a very spontaneous way. Again, I come back to the Houthis and the way he also pushes towards the negotiation or even bombing of Iran. So, I mean, this entire... Do you want to call it a negotiation strategy? But I mean, this entire thing about intimidating your opponent and trying to, sort of force others to do what you think is in your best interest. I mean, this kind of bullying strategy. I'm not sure whether it really works. I mean, it certainly doesn't work with Russia, because I mean, he's maintained so many times that he could solve the Ukraine war quickly and that he also has some kind of leverage over Russia. Apparently he hasn't. Mm-hmm. And I mean, when it comes to everything that I hear regarding any deal with the Iranians, it's also pretty unclear. Mm-hmm. And I mean, George W. Bush back then said all options are on the table, meaning a military confrontation. He doesn't use words like that, but I mean... Yeah, he's no revolutionary. I don't really see any clear pattern. Right. Maybe also because if you listen to the news, and it's good that you don't do that on a regular basis, and also I tend not to do that very frequently. If you just listen to like Mike Walls, to Pete Hegseth, to Marco Rubio, to Donald Trump, like four people who you would expect to at least pursue a common strategy or, you know, they... at times say completely different things and you are completely disoriented and flabbergasted of what is happening. If that's part of a strategy, okay, then maybe I'm not intelligent enough to understand the overall strategy, but to me it seems to be very inconsistent.
But that's what I would actually describe as revolution. Because I don't think you can have a clear strategy when you want to break some, like a break with you can say tradition, you can say with the order. But if you want to break something, I mean, of course, like the description, the Economist did back in the day is like a wrecking ball. I think it definitely describes him really well because he wants to...
Certainly a wrecking ball. But I mean, if you think about the French Revolution, if you think about the Russian Revolution, they all had, you know, larger political ideas, ideologies and, visions behind it. I don't see any vision behind Trump's America. I mean, is it just
and of course it's
bringing
not-
back... American jobs? I mean, yes, the system is broken. We have to fix it. But I mean, that's not a revolutionary agenda. I mean, because it's at times it's like micromanaged and it's like, oh, more cars should be produced in the United States. But I mean, that's not a revolution. That's just, I mean, that's, just an incredibly, I mean, that's a side aspect of things. And I mean, as such, also that the system must go, of course, is one component of a revolution. Mm-hmm. And I mean, they may no longer have the kind of forks, you know, with which they, you know, walk the streets and otherwise storm a place like the Bastille, or you could say the January 6th riots, where something like that. I mean, that sounds terrible and awkward. But I mean, I don't see that kind of revolution. I mean, a lot of the rhetoric is there of, you know, it's a common sense revolution or common sense will dominate. He's allegedly or thinks of himself as a unifier also. I don't see them. The same goes for, you know, bringing peace to the world. So, I mean, a lot of the announcements actually sound very nice. But if you look at the kind of tactics of the ways he wants to bring them about, at least they seem to be very counterintuitive. But I mean, maybe that's also similar to kind of your key, very counterintuitive argument that you want to make in your thesis about Russia. About it's also Russia. A counterintuitive argument.
It's also, let me see if we can connect this. I mean, with Trump, of course, it's also a top-down revolution. It's not bottom-up. But revolutions are always messy. You cannot really... I mean, like, Russian Revolution was...
And there is always a counter-revolution.
You know, of course, if you think about... But those were bottom-up revolutions. It's just like a top-down revolution. Again, I still think it's something that But he's also, I mean, it's just like 4 months since inauguration, so to speak, right? It's also, I guess he also wants to do quite a lot in this first year, because I think in the American political cycle, brings a lot of momentum, like in first year. And then, of course, you start thinking about, I mean, he doesn't need to re-elect, but he will think about his legacy and how to, you know, solidify political system around him, how to win elections, nevertheless.
Some would not say solidify, but dismantle the entire American system. And I mean, Congress has been muted in a way. And I mean, you haven't heard a lot about it.
Right.
I mean, he's certainly changing the political system significantly. He's intimidating people. And I mean, how things play out now with judges is something we'll see. I mean,
he has a crazy billionaire around him all the time.
Who is now no longer working for him officially, yes.
I actually stopped even following the news. Yeah, you see, completely got out of the news cycle to focus on you know, my argument.
Well, you sometimes see things clearer if you don't follow the news on a daily basis. That's certainly the case.
And all the news that should reach to you, they reach without even news cycle, so to speak, which is interesting. But coming back to, of course, the question of, you know, Russia and... because, for example, if, you know, my kind of hypothesis is correct, that, you know, Russian war in Ukraine is like Russian negotiation strategy for Russian place, you can say in the West, you can also say in the European security architecture. I think those, you know, terms that you can kind of use interchangeably, at least in this context. I would say that's why, you know, Putin doesn't want to agree on any type of deal where he doesn't see the prospect, so to speak, for Russia to engage with the West. Because I think Russians are open to, like, what they would say, I mean, if you follow their rhetoric, they are open to real negotiations, as they would say, that accommodate Russian, real Russian interests. But that's what Trump doesn't really offer. What he offers is just... kind of Korean scenario, or, you know, it's just like freeze the conflict for indefinite, you know, future, and let's just have a ceasefire, which from Russian perspective is complete. I mean, I made this argument way back in January and December that if Trump's plan is just a ceasefire, Russians would never accept it, because from Russian perspective, what should happen is some type of way to can get to European security architecture. Because from my long-term argument and vision, how Russia would probably use the Ukraine, they need to, I mean, of course, have a peace. And then they would probably want to have a strong leverage over, let's say, allowing or not allowing Ukraine to join European Union. And they probably would insist on joining European Union or at least free trade agreement only with Russia, so to speak. Which this is just my basic vision. How it's like if you go from the current news, why they do not agree to any type of ceasefire, at least for now, for example. Which, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think I would like to sort of disentangle that. The first one is sort of on a kind of common sense, or say, Western perspective, because common sense is now a charged term, right? Mm-hmm. With the way that Trump, for instance, uses it. But I mean, the idea of if you just approach it, it is incredibly counterintuitive, to say the least, that you basically fight a war in order to bring yourself closer to at least those adversaries who sided with the country that you attack. So, I mean, if you think of it as a... Now, if you think of it in a strategic sense, more in geopolitical terms, going back to the old Mackinder and other people, that you say the most important landmass in the world is the Eurasian landmass. It is sort of, you could say, artificially divided by the conflict in Ukraine, and also the Cold War, you know, was eventually overcome. So, I mean, if one thinks of it in a historical way of centuries, I mean... It would be sort of artificial or unusual or strange if there was something like what you basically alluded to with the Korea scenario. What is sort of unclear for me is, first of all, what the overall motive for the Russians is. I mean, if you also again think of it, looking at the last, say, 200 years of Russian presence in Europe, it has always been that Russia has allied with some other European power. Now, this seems to have been overcome, at least after 45, with the fact that even after Brexit, the EU or, say, NATO, and a lot of that is sort of identical in terms of the sheer landmass, is now sort of the bloc that is or would be a potential partner with the Russians. So, I mean, what I don't fully understand is, I mean, that Russia wants to integrate into Europe. I find that per se plausible, how that should look like, whether it's more economic than military or whether it's both. That's something that, I mean, I would be curious to learn. What it could also be, of course, is one where Trump comes in again, and that is, I could also imagine that, of course, any Russian cooperation with Europe would have a more powerful Russia if the American presence in Europe was basically gone. So, I mean, I'm not sure whether this intention is also technically one that is directed against the Americans in order to really ensure that what Macron called European strategic autonomy, or that there is at least a stronger detachment of or reduction of the American presence in Europe, is the actual goal of Russia, or whether it's all of that at the same time.
I think I can reformulate it and say, I think what they try to achieve, some form of like recognition that Russia is a European power, that it has a place in Europe. And this is very consistent with Russian basically narrative, like the last 30, 40 years. And he just wants to get a seat in this common table, which is, you know, Europe, which is like a very important region in the world, obviously. But Russia, I think, feels that it belongs to it. And it, of course, feels that it's really excluded. I don't necessarily think that they need the US to pull back entirely from Europe, because during Yeltsin, I think the strategy was actually, okay, let's befriend Americans, and then that's our ticket to security architecture. Obviously, I mean, you cannot blame them, because Americans basically decide now Euro-Atlantic security architecture on their own. So I think Russian strategy evolves, but I think the goal is still there. Like the goal is just to get the place. How do we get the place in European table? Because for them, when the system collapsed, and, you know, if you go to Russians, they would say, you know, it collapsed, but it collapsed in a way, it's like we initiated...
When you talk about Russians, you mean...
Gorbachev and...
Like Russian politicians.
Right. We initiated the end of the Cold War with the good intentions to reformulate European security architecture, to reformulate, like, the border, to stop the deterrence, you know, to really build, you know, peace in Europe. And, of course, what people would say, it's like folded on itself, so to speak, because they made a lot of resistance to this idea from the Americans, because Americans clearly were not interested in allowing Russia to kind of join this whole security architecture. So from my thinking, it's like the end goal, strategic end goal is there, because Russia needs China to an extent. It can, you know, help it, like to say, economically now, but Russia doesn't, you know, it cannot really integrate with China anywhere, because it's two civilizations, it's two big economies. That's why, of course, Russia sees, I mean, and the most profound economic growth would come from Europe for Russia, would come from integrating into the market. You know, it doesn't necessarily mean that Russia wants to become European Union, because it will lose political autonomy, but it definitely wants to be in the market. It definitely wants to, you know, for Russian people to travel to Europe and vice versa. So this is the goal, so to speak.
Would you say that's part of the economy, or isn't it kind of the long historic, you know, trends? Russian nobility spoke French. I mean, you know, they had the entire connection to, no, to yeah. I mean, Russian tourists rather going to Europe than to Asia. I mean, I see those kind of long historic trends. Also, just if you look at the map, of course, there is this impressive landmass of Russia. But if you think of it where sort of the, if it still exists, kind of Russian soft power or, you know, cultural and other aspects take place. I mean, the center is, of course, Moscow. Second one would be the former capital, St. Petersburg. Of course, they are both very much to the west of the country. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you look at it, and St. Petersburg really is just across, you know, the Baltic Sea from Finland. So, I mean, it is that clearly, I mean, both are also geographically speaking part of Europe.
I mean, how I think even from infrastructure perspective, I mean, you could have, if you build a fast-paced railroad system, you can go from Moscow to Berlin in a couple of hours. If there is a will and desire to achieve that, they would have done it already. It's that close from space. And from Russian perspective, and just from, I would say, from just describing things, the more east you go, the less you see the differences between, because Eastern European nations, they evolved pretty, you know, like later than France, Germany, what have you. So they have like a lot of similarities. They share same kind of cultural past. So now to go and say, okay, we accept Ukraine in Europe, but we don't accept Russia. I mean, from a Russian perspective, again, there is like just anger and frustration. It's like you, times and times again, you come to us and you call us, you know, barbarians, non-Europeans. But even though you consume Russian culture, even though Russian culture is part of European heritage, this what doesn't make sense, I guess, from a Russian perspective. And this is what they're fighting for. I mean, this is like their strong will to say, okay, if we lose Ukraine, we will lose any type of connection to the West. What you call Europe, again, doesn't really matter.
I mean, that's sort of between the lines, right? Because that's not part of the official rhetoric. I mean, you won't find it. Like, if you look at Gorbachev and his metaphor of the common house, yes. But if we talk about Putin, I think things are different. And I think from my sort of lay observation, also as someone who doesn't speak Russian and who has followed the news, you know, only on a superficial basis. But I mean, I see that, you know, he seems to have, tried to accommodate some American interests after 9/11 with opening military bases. He then basically has been, for good or bad, been consistent with regard to the way he sort of reads the map in a geopolitical way with the Munich Security Conference speech. Mm-hmm. And I mean, still then, I think, try to increase Russian soft power by things like hosting the Football World Cup, having the Olympic Games in Sochi. And I mean, maybe that's just, you know, pure speculation, but I mean that these kind of attempts also were not really interpreted correctly, or you know, were not really well received or received well enough by Western powers. It's something, I mean, that's again all pure speculation. What I would say is that if one looks at the way how, you know, any conflict, no matter over which, you know, the conflict is fought, I mean how they are ended, that either you are able to really bring your enemy down to one's knees, or you know, to basically have like the total surrender, as as happened in World War II with Japan and Germany. And that is not something that, I mean, we can see. First of all, because Russia is a nuclear power. Second, because it has a large landmass. Third, because it has a comparatively larger army than the Ukrainian ones. I mean, this all would be a lot of, you know, hypothetical thinking. So, I mean, a lot of it then, I think, is about what are actually the strategic intentions of Russia. And so far, the narrative in, I'd say, most Western capitals is it's a neo-imperial power that once Ukraine falls, is actually at our doorsteps and will invade the Baltic states and Poland, and you know, tanks will roll into Berlin. And now, no matter whether that actually makes sense or not, because I mean, I think we can leave that for a future debate. Is something that you just see that the narratives or the overall strategic motivations, at least as they are communicated, are so, you know, irreconcilable that that I don't see how any kind of confidence building measures or an end of the conflict in Ukraine could come about, except for a ceasefire at the moment. So now, is Russia currently in a position where its military is stronger than the Ukrainian one? Yes, in brackets, unfortunately. But I mean, so I think as such, the idea that Ukraine, for instance, with that incursion into Kursk, the Kursk Oblast, would actually be able to somehow increase its negotiation position is something that hasn't worked out. So, I mean, this was the entire idea, right, to bring the Ukraine into a better negotiation position, negotiating position. I think that hasn't worked out. So, I mean, it's now really up for some kind of strategic vision. And if you just read the news, it's about, oh, Friedrich Merz now has, you know, step up and declare whether we will, I mean, the Germans or the Europeans will support Ukraine by delivering more weapons and make up for those Americans' weapons that would end up in Ukraine. These are all, I mean, debates that I think are also not discussing alternative options. And I mean, I'm not saying, you know, the Russians only want peace. I'm, you know, I don't want to sound naive, but I mean, this, the entire way that things are being discussed when it comes to the Ukraine war are very one-dimensional, I think, for the last 3 years. And I mean, I think for both sides, it is, meaning Russia and the Europeans, it is not possible to continue with the current situation for, say, more than 2 years. I mean, there needs to be some kind of
change
or solution in the end, of course, and how that will look like.
And I mean,
I don't have any real idea, to be honest.
I mean, I have an idea. I guess you can sense it from my, there should be some understanding. I mean, once the West, I mean, I would even argue that once someone is, I mean, once I would say you convince the West that the only logical solution is to integrate Russia, I think like the pieces will fold in their right.
But I mean, that position. I mean, of course, I mean, that must also be clear for, I mean, especially an experienced person like Lavrov. Like, you cannot possibly think that European powers, even if they are not superior in a military way, could accept that, you know, that, you know, we actually want you to be our partners, and that's why, you know, we started a war with a country that was, you know, supposed to have an accession talks with the European Union.
But
that's like a very bizarre kind of thought, and at the same time, there are so many hybrid ways of, you know, conflict that are taking place with the undersea cables, with kind of cyber attacks. And I'm not saying that, you know, it's only the Russians, but I mean, the relationship between Russia and the West has been one of covert and open conflict for now a long period of time. So I mean, I think the most important thing is establishing secure lines or like reliable channels of communication, really trying to understand what the real motivations are. And I mean, if I just, you know, read the reports about the threat assessment, I mean, I'm not terribly optimistic, because I mean, some people say that Russians will mobilize even more troops. I mean, weapons productions is going up. So I mean, as such, at least in terms of you know, posturing or, you know, a threat perception, I mean, alarm bells are ringing in European capitals. So I mean, it's I think it's a very, very difficult decision for for decision makers in the West. And the question is, I mean, I think what you refer to seems to be pretty much described as a security dilemma, right? That Hertz, you know, already, right, you know, referred to over, I think, 60 years ago.
In a way, but I would say for me it's more, because security dilemma is something that comes from like rational thinking. It's more about just seeing the deeper meaning behind Russian actions, especially if you create this. Because it also doesn't make sense why the country that publicly wanted to build economic zone or security zone from Lisbon to Vladivostok, and Gorbachev back in the day called from, you know, Atlantic to, how do they call it? So it's like expand from the whole Atlantic area, including Russia, how it changed, you know, 160 degrees, and now suddenly Russia doesn't want to do anything with Europe. And just like to maybe to end our conversation, because you mentioned that it's not in Russian rhetoric anymore, but actually it still is in Russian rhetoric. Because whenever you listen to Lavrov, and sometimes even Putin, they all say it's like Russia belongs to Europe. They still say the same thing, Russia belongs to Europe. And any conflict resolution without reconfiguration of European security architecture is impossible. That's what they say. It's just there. And it's just, you know, and you just need to listen to carefully and, you know, then analyze. And then, of course, my kind of, I would say, analytical goal here is to show that the West really, failing to understand the deeper sense of Russian actions, of course, it, again, you can say it creates this dilemma. It creates it creates this negative dynamic in relations that leads times and times again to cycles. Okay, thank you, David. I think it was a very interesting conversation.
We'll continue that.
Okay, see you in the next one.
Thank you.